Good morning. I'm Donna Lang. I am the chair of the Stewardship Committee this year. And I wanted to talk with you this morning about gratitude and giving before we begin our announcements for today. So I've been thinking about, you know, as we kind of enter this season of gratitude and thinking about gratitude for military service and abundance and family and all of the little things that I think are really important to remember in this time. And so it makes me think about, for me, in my life, some of the things that I am most grateful for actually came as a result of a decision to join a UU church about 20 years ago, where I found community and great friends, and I met my husband. And so I am grateful to be part of this community, and I feel enriched by it. And I'm grateful for all the opportunities that we have here for putting our faith into action through social justice, from Thanksgiving baskets and gifts for families and shelters, as well as for the ways that we challenge ourselves and make our principles known in the larger community. So as I think about those things, I'm thinking about this place as a really important and vital part of our community, and I'm grateful to be part of it. And this time of year, a lot of us start thinking about giving. You know, in our gratitude, we also want to give back. And that comes up around this time for Giving Tuesday, you know, the Tuesday after Thanksgiving and the Tuesday after Black Friday and Cyber Monday and all the sales. There comes Giving Tuesday. And so we would just ask, as you think about your charitable giving for this year, to remember FPC, because we are a really vital and vibrant and important part of our local community. So thank you. And this morning, I want to invite you to attend Coffee Hour this morning in Fellowship Hall after services. To get there, you can use the doors to my left and follow the hallway down to the end, down the stairs or the elevator. You can just follow the crowd. And childcare is also available during our services in the nursery, which is in the lower level of Fellowship Hall. And you can get there in the same way and then continue down the steps. And usher can also help you to get there. If this is your first time with us, we're very happy to have you here. Welcome. Please sign one of our guest books. And they're located out in the vestibule and then also at the visitor's table at coffee hour. And that way we can get you on the mailing list and you'll receive updates and announcements. And at this time in our service, I'd like to invite you to greet your neighbor. Thank you. Thank you. I did something. I'm sorry.
It's okay. Our opening words this morning come from Margaret A. Kipe. As surely as we belong to the universe, we belong together. We join here to transcend the isolated self, to reconnect, to to know ourselves to be at home here on earth, under the stars, linked with each other. Mike is going to light our chalice as I share these words. For the wonder and inspiration we seek from sun and stars and all the lights of the heavens, we light this chalice. And please rise in body or spirit for our opening hymn number 203. We're going to sing only three verses of this, numbers 1, 2, and 4. 1, 2, 4. I know you're all wondering, what about three? What was wrong with three? The answer is simple. I thought four had more of an ending feel than three left us hanging a little bit to me. That's all. It's a lovely verse. 100 years ago today, on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, the guns fell silent on the Western Front, and an armistice was declared. In that memory and in honor of our veterans today, we will toll our bell 11 times. I'd like to invite all of our veterans in our congregation to rise in body or spirit. If you're unable to rise, raise your arm for us and let us recognize you this morning. thank you for your service. Thank you. Thank you for your service, and we pledge to you that we will not only remember you and remember the service of the brave men and women and people who have served our country, but also that we will do what we can to make the armistice a little more permanent and lasting one on this earth. These words for prayer or meditation come from Audette Fulbright Folsom. Today, we bow our heads in recognition of the great service and sacrifice some have been asked to make. Living through the horror that is war, facing death or physical harm as a specter looming around any corner, we say thank you and know it will never be enough. Help us to embrace those we have sent forth in our names into danger. Give us the strength of will to serve them as they have served us. May they never hunger. May they never thirst. May there always be meaningful work for their hands. May they receive healing care in abundance. And may we, the grateful heirs of a nation built on the idea of liberty, be faithful to pursuing that dream in our own lives and actions. Help us to be vigilant and never complacent. Let each of us personally take this charge. May it be so, and may it be so. Blessed be. Amen. This is a special day in our community. It's one of 2 days a year when we formally open up our arms and ask new members to join with us in a formal ceremony. Now, you can join at any time during the year, but we do it in the service twice a year particularly. The rest of the time, usually it's done by a private ceremony, and you can do it by a private ceremony today if you want to, too. Just see Jolene after the service, and we'll arrange that for you. But we like to do this in community when possible because it's a pretty sacred part of the free church tradition. Unitarian Universalism is, and only is, us, members of congregations. That's who this whole faith is. Freely joining to be in voluntary community together as members. And the act is a really simple one. You sign our book, then you're a member. But it's a profound one, and so we build a little ritual around it because we want to honor that this is something that means something. It means that you are freely choosing to be part of this community, that you want to make it your home, be able to say, yes, I am a member of FPC, and for us to be your home in return. So you're pledging to help, to volunteer, to pledge to the extent of your ability, to do other things that you can do to help make this community successful. And then in turn, we're pledging to you to welcome you, to treat you as part of this community, to listen to your ideas, to let you change us as we change you. And so I want to, oh, guess what, too? Guess who joined this morning? I did! And Peter did, too. Yeah, so thank you. I feel very welcomed. Peter joined too. Katie is out of town this weekend, unfortunately, so we'll have her do one of those private ceremonies later, because youth 12 and older can be an associate member of this church as well. And so I wanted to make sure to say that. So if there's anyone who's interested in joining today, I invite you to come forward. And Jolene, our membership development coordinator, will come forward as part of this ceremony. And Hector is chair of our membership committee. And Katie is representing our board of trustees as our vice president. Wonderful. It is always exciting when someone who has joined as an associate member or who has grown up in this church joins again as an adult member. To our gathered community, I say, today we welcome into membership of this church this group of friends who have freely chosen to join the First Parish Church of Stowe and Acton in religious fellowship. Membership here does not require adherence to a creed, to a set of beliefs. Rather, it is an act of covenant, a promise that we make together about how we wish to be in religious community together and how the values we wish to promote in the world are held among us. Despite our diversity in beliefs, we covenant together to join in the ministry to each other as a beloved community to this world as we seek to bend the arc towards justice. Sometimes this is just snowballs. We get one, and then we get another, and another. But we're ready for them. Nope, stay up here. Because we have more things.
So this is the part of us. You're going to read when it's time. Okay, so first, Katie's going to read this. Then together we
read. And the rest of you can be pulling out this yellow piece of paper in your... Got it? Ready? And remember that when you encounter the words great rejoicing, you have to sound like you're doing it with great rejoicing. Okay? To the new members, you have signified your desire to become members of this religious fellowship. By choosing membership, you are choosing to enter into a relationship, a ministry, a set of connections.
We welcome you to First Parish Church of Stowe and Acton. Membership here comes with both privileges and commitments. As members, we come together to grow spiritually and intellectually, to create community, and to do the work of love and justice in this world. We will count on you, as you count on us, to speak the truth with courage and with love, to support the work of this church with your time, money, and creativity, and to care for one another in times of need.
The light takes many forms, but whatever it takes, it always the quest for meaning. What some may call the search for God, I bring to this church my unique self, seeking to join with others in our quest for truth and meaning. I recognize with a free faith comes responsibility, and I desire to join in building a church that strengthens community and our connections to our deepest callings.
So together we're going to read aloud the covenant and affirmation. So before we go on to our next step, which you'll see is on that orange piece of paper, the yellow piece of paper, I just wanted these, our three new members, to just very quickly introduce yourself, okay? Maybe share your name, your grade, whatever, where you're from, how you landed here today.
My name is Luke Droz, and I live in Acton.
My name is Vivian Banks. I'm a junior in high school. And I live in Acton, right up the road from Luke.
I'm Rose Mallon, and I live in Marlboro, and it's a good place to live.
It is. I live there, too. Yeah.
So I have a little ceremony, and you can open your bags for this because we realized we gave you a lot of stuff to hold after the first services experience. Because I've added this little ritual here. The theologian James Luther Adams talked about five smooth stones of religious liberalism. Now, he used the metaphor of five smooth stones because it took five stones for David in the Bible to kill the giant Goliath. So he talks about these smooth stones as being the core things to our faith that keep us together, keep us thriving, make us able to do our work in the world. And they are listed on the back of your yellow sheet. The first is the search. The revelation, this is the search for truth and meaning, as we say in our fifth principle, that revelation is continuous, that there's always something more we can learn about faith and about the world. And so this stone represents that. The second stone is for consent, because this is a free faith. Our faith teaches us that we are free people and that our relationships we build here are based on consent and not coercion. The third smooth stone is agency. We believe in personal agency. Oh, justice! Can't forget justice. Justice. Our faith teaches us that we have an obligation to work towards a just and more loving world. And the fourth one is agency. That we believe, look at this, that we believe that our faith lets us know that we can work for good things to happen in the world. So it's not all predetermined. We have personal agency. And last but not least, that small thing with feathers, hope. So our faith teaches us that there is actually reason to hope, that the world can become a more just and loving place. There you go. Thank you, and welcome again. It's good to have you with us. If you have a thing on, I'll take it. Welcome. Welcome. Yeah, that's tricky. Welcome. Turned it off too.
So Michelle's not here for the second service this morning, so I just wanted to let you know that now is the time where we take the light from our chalice, we light our lantern, and we bring that light to the RE classes for today. Do we have a chalice? Do we have a bearer today?
I don't know. Let's ask for a volunteer.
Who would like to bring the lantern forward? Nope. He's like, nope. What about one of our older folks upstairs? Do we have a volunteer? Oh, yay, thank you, Vivian. Come on down. You can grab your flowers, too.
Our reading this morning is from The Varieties of Scientific Experience by Carl Sagan. It begins, Let me read a passage from Thomas Paine from The Age of Reason. Paine was an Englishman who played a major role in both the American and French revolutions. From whence, Paine asks, from whence then could arise the solitary and strange conceit that the Almighty, who had millions of worlds equally dependent on his protection, should quit the care of all the rest and come to die in our world because, they say, one man and one woman ate an apple? And, on the other hand, are we to suppose that every world in the boundless creation had an Eve, an apple, a serpent, and a redeemer? Paine, he continues, is saying that we have a theology that is earth-centered and involves a tiny piece of space. And when we step back, when we attain a broader cosmic perspective, some of it seems very small in scale. And in fact, a general problem with much of Western theology, in my view, is that the God portrayed is too small. It is a God of a tiny world and not a God of a galaxy, much less of a universe. Now we can say, well, that's just because the right words weren't available back when the first Jewish or Christian or Islamic holy books were written. But clearly that's not the problem. It is certainly possible in the beautiful metaphors in these books to describe something like the galaxy and the universe, and it isn't there. It's a God of one small world, a problem, I believe, that theologians have not adequately addressed. I don't propose that it is a virtue to revel in our limitations, but it's important to understand how much we do not know. There is an enormous amount we do not know. There is a tiny amount that we do. But what we do understand brings us face to face with an awesome cosmos, and that is simply different from the cosmos of our pious ancestors. Thus ends the reading. This month we share our plate with Habitat for Humanity that works to build homes for people out in the community, and similarly we take our morning collection for building our religious home here. For the works of these two good organizations, we will now gratefully receive the morning offering. Thank you. That's the time when I worship. So this week I'm out of town from Monday through Thursday, and that happens annually in November when I go to a ministerial study group. There are a number of these groups around the country where about 30 or so UU ministers get together and study a topic annually. And this year we're studying speech at the group that I attend. Different people write papers, and then we have responses to those papers. They're like an hour long, 45-minute papers, and then we discuss, debate, et cetera, as UUs are prone to doing. And about 5 years ago, the topic was space. And it was transformative for me as I heard these papers. And I'm going to refer to two or three of those papers in this sermon because they became such important touchstones for me that I've returned to them time and time again in various sermons just because they resonate so strongly with my own theology. Also, Carl Sagan's birthday was Friday. I create a calendar before I choose my worship themes of different holidays and holy days and different events that have happened in the world. And I always put Carl Sagan's birthday on my calendar because he was such an important figure to many people. But for me, I think not just an author and a scientist, but also really a theologian. When I read Carl Sagan's words, when I read the words that I shared with you in the reading, I thought, yes, that is it. That's the problem with fundamentalist religion today, with biblical literalism. Those who cling to the Bible as divinely inspired, each and every word, literally the truth, are clinging to an earth-centered theology in a time when the whole universe is unfolding before us. Remember how Galileo was tried and convicted of heresy for saying the sun was at the center of the universe? And eventually, theology caught up with that concept, and theologically, we put the sun at the center. And ever since then, we've had this theological view of one God up in heaven, maybe essentially in the sun, looking down on this one planet and watching us. But our theology stopped at our solar system. It didn't embrace the larger galaxy or the galaxies upon galaxies upon galaxies, each spinning in an infinite universe. We've kept God too small. Carl Sagan writes, "By the time of Copernicus, a serious objection to a geocentric universe was a theological offense. And you can see why. Because if Copernicus were right, then the Earth would be demoted. No longer the Earth, the world, but just a world, an Earth, one of many. And then came the still more unsettling possibility, the idea that the stars were distant suns, and that they also had planets going around them, and that, after all, you can see thousands of stars with the naked eye. Suddenly, the Earth is not only central to this solar system, but no longer central to any solar system. And then there was the hope that, well, at least maybe our galaxy was at the center of all the other galaxies, all those billions of galaxies. But modern views have it that there is no such thing as a center to the universe, at least not in ordinary three-dimensional space. And we are certainly not at it." So he continues, "Those who wished for some central cosmic purpose for us, or at least for our world, at least for our solar system, or at least for our galaxy, have been disappointed, progressively disappointed." Think about it. How, in the light of these billions upon billions upon billions of stars, does the idea of a God who sends one sun to one earth, and only through faith in him do you go to heaven, how does that theology make sense? Now, I'm not throwing out all concept of God or even all concept of Jesus as a savior with it, but this just this brand of salvific literalism. Our Bible is founded, and this literal reading of the Bible is founded upon the idea that human beings are somehow special, more special than the animals, set apart from them, given dominion over them, special and important, and made us and only us in the image of God. But what we know of space is the opposite. The Reverend Don Cooley writes in the Copernican Principle, writes that the Copernican Principle, also called the Principle of Mediocrity, tells us that our planet, quote, does not occupy a special position or status in the universe. It is apparently a typical planet around a typical star in a typical galaxy. If this is the case, she continues, and we assume that we are about average as far as galaxies go, one can make the case that there are 50 billion planets multiplied by 80 billion galaxies, or 4 sextillion planets in the observable universe, approximately 40 quintillion in a habitable zone. To her words, I add, our earthbound theology tells us that this earth is the only one that Jesus came to, the only one with humans, the only one with beings made in God's image. Impossible. Impossible. By way of analogy, consider this story from Daniel Quinn's Ishmael, An Adventure of the Mind and Spirit, in which an anthropologist is interviewing a creature that he finds along a shore. He greets the creature, and he talks with it for a while, interviews it, and then asks it to tell it the stories of its people. Stories, the other asked? You know, like your creation myth, if you have one. Certainly, we have an account of creation, the other snapped. But it is definitely not a myth. Oh, certainly not, the anthropologist said, remembering his training at last. I'll be terribly grateful if you'll share it with me. And so at last, the creature began its story. The universe, it said, was born a long, long time ago, perhaps 10 or 15 billion years ago. Our own solar system, this star, this planet, and all the others seem to have come into being 2 or 3 billion years ago. For a long time, nothing lived here. But after a billion or so years, life appeared. For many millions of centuries, the life of the world was merely microorganisms floating helplessly in a chemical broth. But little by little, more complex forms appeared, single-celled creatures, slimes, algae, polyps, and so on. But finally, the creature said, turning quite pink with pride as he came to the climax of his story, but finally, jellyfish appeared. The Reverend Don Cooley says of this, the point, expressed a few pages later, is that the creation stories are most often told by humankind as if we are the pinnacle of creation. But finally, Homo sapiens appeared. As if evolution, speciation, and the entire process of the universe stopped when humanity appeared. As if it had all been building towards us, the entire universe. Now, for many people, this view of humanity as the pinnacle of creation makes them feel important, feel significant, feel cherished in an otherwise cold and indifferent world. The vastness of space is too large and too impersonal to contemplate. But I don't think that letting go of the earth-based view has to mean losing all sense of importance and connection. For example, the scientists who search for extraterrestrial life, like Carl Sagan's fictional character Ellie Arroway in Contact, do so partly for a sense of connection and of meaning. Paul Davies, in his book Are We Alone, writes, "The modern search for aliens is, at rock bottom, part of an ancient religious question. The interest in SETI among the general public stems, in part, I maintain, from a need to find a wider context for our lives than this earthly existence provides." A wider context for our lives, he says. I want to share a story that the Reverend Mark Bellatini shared in his paper called The Cosmic Theology of Carl Sagan. He writes of being a senior in high school and hanging out with friends, and they suddenly decide to leave Detroit and drive across the Ambassador Bridge into Canada. It was easier in those days. We did used to often do that, just drive over to Canada on a whim with a group of friends. And once they were there, they decide to head out onto the point overlooking Lake Michigan, Point Pelee. He writes, no, that's not Lake Michigan, sorry. Like Huron, Erie, I don't know. Anyway, Lake Michigan, whole other side of the state. What am I thinking? The sunset that day lavishly painted the whole sky to match the October trees that lined the tobacco fields. It was beautiful. By the time we reached the point, the red sky had given way to indigo and finally to deep black. It was about 8:30. We parked, followed a dimly lit path through a wood, always led by the call of lapping waves on the other side of the trees. We broke out onto the beach. We all remarked on how dark it is when you get so far from the city lights. There was no moonlight yet that night, or maybe it was a new moon, I don't remember. Suddenly, someone, I forget who, said quietly, "Look up. My God." And we all tilted our heads heavenward. I was immediately bowled over. It looked to me as if the glittering stars covered more area than the black background holding them. I saw the Milky Way for the first time in my life that night, as clear as sands, as a path on the sand in daylight. The small cluster of stars called the Pleiades were so vivid, I felt as if they were only the width of a face apart from my own. Near my house on Detroit's east side, I was able to pick out a few constellations, the Dipper, the huge W of Cassiopeia, but here at the point, I couldn't find them. The stars and the planets among them formed a whole for the first time. No patterns, no shapes, no fabled Greek stories across the heavens. And within me, but for a moment, I felt transported beyond my own little life. I felt I understood in my whole being that I was on a small planet on the edge of things, suspended over an infinite abyss of both beauty and coldness. I could suddenly feel as if my skin was no longer a boundary between the inside and the outside, and I realized that the stars, the abyss, the small rocky planet I was standing on, my friends next to me, the waters of the lake, the sand on the beach, made up but one indivisible reality. One awesomeness that transformed my capacity to speak of it, but which called forth my deepest wonder, respect, honor, and gratitude for everything around me. Mark's story illustrates the essence of Sagan's theology, that, as Mark put it, we find ourselves between two poles. We are precious, and we are insignificant. People are often quick to see how the vastness of time and space shows how insignificant we are. And indeed, the insignificance is awesome and terrifying. This is the easiest thing to see about space. In the vastness, the emptiness, it makes the hunger for a personal God that much more visceral. But Sagan saw within science and space that other pole as well. He was often known for talking about how we are made of stardust, star stuff, in every atom. He said, the nitrogen in our DNA, the calcium in our teeth, the iron in our blood, the carbon in our apple pies were made in the interiors of collapsing stars. I want you to remember that at the Harvest Fair time. We are made of star stuff. In the book and movie Contact, his astronaut, Eleanor Arroway, is sent into space to make first contact with an alien species. And when she meets one, one tells her, "You're an interesting species, an interesting mix. You're capable of such beautiful dreams and such horrible nightmares. You feel so lost, so cut off, so alone, only you're not. See, in all our searching, the only thing we've found that makes the emptiness bearable is each other." In the novel, Sagan writes, "The cosmos may be densely populated with intelligent beings, but the Darwinian lesson is clear. There will be no humans elsewhere, only here, only on this small planet. We are a rare as well as endangered species. If a human disagrees with you, let him or her live. In 100 billion galaxies, you will not find another. Precious." In Contact, Ellie Arroway says, I was given something wonderful, something that changed me forever, a vision of the universe that tells us undeniably how tiny and insignificant and how rare and precious we are. A vision that tells us how we belong to something that is greater than ourselves, that we are not, that none of us are alone. Carl Sagan closes one of his essays with this illustration of a poem by Lily Emery. "My kind didn't really slither out of a tidal pool, did we? God, I need you to believe you created me. We are so small down here." And Sagan replies, "I think there's a very general truth that Lily Emery expresses in this poem. I believe everyone on some level recognizes that feeling. And yet, if we are merely matter intricately assembled, is that really demeaning? If there's nothing here but atoms, does that make us matter less? Or does that make us matter more?" Sagan's narrator says of Ellie in Cosmos, "She had studied the universe all her life, but overlooked its clearest message. For such small creatures as we, the vastness is bearable only through love." It astounded me when I read this. Carl Sagan looks into that vastness of space, and the message he comes away with is love. Amazingly, yes, that is the answer. While he'll cite all the numbers that make us seem very, very small here on our tiny planet hurtling through space, the message of his book, of his movies, of all his works is the intimacy of the universe. When Ellie Arroway goes out into space, she meets the alien, and he takes the form of her father, plucked from her memory, so that she will not feel comforted, or will not feel alone, but will feel comforted. Insignificant, but precious. Love and awe and humility and hope. This is the message of the cosmos to us. This is the religious meaning we can get from a space-based rather than an earth-based theology. Awe and humility and love and hope. We are insignificant, and we are precious indeed. We are star stuff. Please rise in body or in spirit now and join in our closing hymn, number 1064 in your teal hymnals, Blue Boat Home.
Still I draw.
All my ship's companions, all we kindred pilgrim souls, may we go out in peace, may we live in peace, and may we spread that peace until peace reigns our land forevermore.